How could it be so that her house was destroyed by Russian shelling? She should ask the woman whose three children died in a bathroom from Ukrainian shelling how she felt. I also have children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren. I want to live in peace here in Donbas, not watch all this going on.
It's noticeable here that most people are women and children. The men have joined the armies.
Now, the front line is only a few hundred meters away. There's a lot of emotion here, understandably, about this war. Some people here even tell me they have cousins who are fighting in the Ukrainian army, while their sons and husbands are fighting for the pro-Russians. This war has divided the country. It's also divided villages like this.
3 ноября у меня погиб сын. И он воевал.
My son died on the 3rd of November. He'd been on the front line for 8 years. He went there in 2014 as a volunteer, and now he's dead. What for, I ask, what for?
Those who remain don't leave because it's their home, and they have nowhere else to go. They tell me this used to be a pleasant place to live. The same can be said of many other parts of Ukraine. The longer this war goes on, the more of this pleasant land will be destroyed. Johnny Miller, Donbass.
Ahead of a planned visit by U.S. President Joe Biden to the region next month, Israeli media revealed that the American administration had raised the possibility of holding a meeting between the Palestinian Authority and Israel, but the Palestinians have rejected the idea. According to the Israeli daily Haaretz, the Palestinians informed the Americans that they would only accept such a meeting if all parties agreed on advancing a two-state solution based on the 1967 borders.
The Biden administration, with its offer to have a kind of a meeting between the Palestinians and the Israelis, is trying just to get out of the hook. It's trying to say that they are interested in doing something in the area. At the same time, what they are offering is just a kind of a arrangement, economic arrangements, to make life a little bit much better under the occupation. Now, the Palestinian Authority and the Palestinians in general are aiming at ending the occupation and establishing a Palestinian state.
The Palestinians, however, want from the Americans to reopen the U.S. consulate in East Al-Quds and to remove the Palestine Liberation Organization, PLO, from the U.S. terror list. These demands had been made during a meeting between Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas and Assistant Secretary of State for Near Eastern Affairs Barbara Leaf in Ramallah.
Biden's visit carries with it many risks, including shaping the situation in the region in favor of U.S. interests and those of Israel. We have demanded from the U.S. some issues that it can make unilaterally and don't require hollow meetings. It's clear the U.S. will be ignoring the major cause, which is the Palestinian cause.
On Tuesday, the White House confirmed Biden's first trip to West Asia region next month, during which he will visit the occupied Palestine, followed by a trip to Saudi Arabia. Israel's foreign minister has said that his country was looking to Biden's trip next month to help improve relations with Saudi Arabia. U.S. President Joe Biden is planning a visit to Saudi Arabia as part of the Riyadh summit. Biden says he will be focusing on Israel as a key issue for talks during his Saudi visit. Palestinians, on the other hand, say the Biden's visit to the region would only be symbolic. Mona Kandil, Occupied Ramallah.
The EU is Britain's largest trading partner by some distance, and the UK is the EU's third largest customer for goods. Therefore, there's a great deal to lose if relations continue to deteriorate.
This is illegal.
The 27-nation bloc is furious at plans by the British government to rip up the post-Brexit trade agreement relating to Northern Ireland agreed in 2020. Apparently, Boris Johnson's proposals would create a mountain of paperwork for businesses in Northern Ireland.
I mean, go and ask the milk producers in Northern Ireland, how he or she can produce the milk, one sort for EU, another one for the UK, or any kind of manufacturer who wants to benefit from the access to both markets of the UK and the EU.
Brussels is taking London to court for not fulfilling the terms of the so-called Northern Ireland Protocol. The mechanism is designed to prevent border checks between the North and the Republic of Ireland, thereby avoiding the potential for sectarian violence. The United States is siding with the EU on this issue, which means London has limited options when it comes to finding new, big trading partners. Currently, just 15% of UK exports go to the US. And according to analysts, it would take years for London and Washington to agree on a new trade deal. EU leaders simply do not trust the British government any longer. Analysts have been surprised by the bloc's unity throughout the Brexit process after the EU spelled out its red lines.
And the EU has been very consistent in keeping to those red lines, probably more unified than anyone expected. Whereas on the other side, we have seen huge divisions.
This protocol presents for Northern Ireland.
It's been suggested, for political reasons, Johnson cannot back down now, and therefore it would ultimately require a change of government in London to avoid a trade war. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Grounded right before takeoff from a military airport in southwest England, as the legal wrangling over the fate of those due to be deported played out. The crew of the £500,000 taxpayer-funded flight to Rwanda soon realized they weren't going anywhere, as an 11th-hour intervention by the European Human Rights Council granted a reprieve to most of the 7 Middle Eastern asylum seekers on board, to the delight of critics of the government's immigration policy.
I was delighted. It really instilled my confidence in the judicial system, that people could actually pick out favourable politics and look behind that and identify potential breaches of human rights.
A defiant UK Prime Minister, though, says he is pushing on with his policy and that he may now contemplate withdrawing from the European Convention on Human Rights.
What we want to do is to show the people traffickers that they're breaking the law, they're risking people's lives, and it won't work anyway. Now, will it be necessary to change some laws to help us as we go along? It may very well be.
At the moment, the UK's Interior Ministry forcibly removes anyone it deems inadmissible to claim asylum in the UK on a one-way charter flight to Rwanda, and houses them at facilities like this one in the capital, Kigali. A policy that has drawn fierce criticism from charities to the Church of England to rights activists.
Well, the government argument is they're doing this to put people traffickers out of business, but people such as yourself want the policy scrapped altogether. Why?
Immigration, asylum, and human rights are not at the top of the priority of this government's way of working with others, you know, less fortunate than themselves. We see the situation in Rwanda as being dressed up as something that it's absolutely not. I still have clients who are Rwandan refugees.
The UK has reportedly paid cash-strapped Rwanda $148 million up front for the deportation deal, and plans on making additional payments to the East African country based on the number of asylum seekers it deports.
The UK government says it's ready to do anything, including changing the law to make those deportation flights happen. But for now, a respite for desperate asylum seekers facing a terrifying future. Saeed Bouriza, London.
Senior U.S. advisor for energy security Amos Hochstein met high-ranking Lebanese officials in Beirut. During the talks, Lebanese officials said conditions for talks are confidential, but stressed their main demand is Lebanon maintain its right to defend its natural resources.
For the Lebanese government, the point 29 will be considered as a negotiation point, and the 23 point will be considered as the realistic point that will draw the Lebanese borders over the sea.
The conflict over petrol and gas fields began more than 10 years ago when the U.S. proposed a so-called Hough Line, which is lower than Line 23, stripping Lebanon of some 860 square kilometers. President Michel Aoun, Prime Minister Mikati, and Speaker Nabih Berri all stressed a unified stance for Lebanon that the country will not concede its right to begin drilling offshore.
because of the American embargo over on Lebanon, we could not drill for our rights to extract our gas and oil because we have to be delayed until the Israeli and the Zionist entity to extract their wealth before us. Therefore, the American negotiator is taken aside, and it's very obvious that they are not negotiating for our benefit, but for the benefit of our enemy.
A recent move by Israel to attempt drilling in the Karish field, which falls within Line 29, has led to opposition from Beirut. Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah has also warned the floating petrol company Energean against drilling in that area, as long as it is disputed, and also cautioned that Israeli drilling could reach depths closer to potentially gas-rich Lebanese fields. Lebanon's main dilemma now is that time is running out and its natural resources could be looted at any time. Analysts believe the officials need to firstly demand that the U.S. lift its undeclared blockade and allow contracted companies to implement their obligations and drill in purely Lebanese fields. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
The battle for Donbass. Russia has air and artillery superiority. By some accounts, they are pounding Ukrainian positions with 50,000 shells a day. Particularly terrifying are their thermobaric missiles. They cause massive fireballs and suck out the oxygen from the surrounding air. The Ukrainians are well dug in places. These weapons can penetrate their trenches with devastating effect. The Guardian newspaper reports that between 600 and 1,000 Ukrainian soldiers are being killed or wounded every day. A horrific loss of human life and strategically unsustainable. The Russians, too, are thought to have had high casualties. It has been a long time since they have released their figures, but it is they who are moving forward slowly but surely. Peace talks broke down early on in the conflict. Both sides have had little interest in them since.
People have been dying here for years. We have thousands of infrastructure items destroyed. What about could we talk to Ukraine about now? And what Ukraine are we talking to? The one that is a terrorist state? There's no logic and no sense in negotiating with terrorists, for they'll be constantly changing their demands and trying to turn them in their favor. There have been negotiations from the beginning of liberation operation, and as you can see, it ends in nothing.
President Zelensky has made clear that he is not interested in talks unless Russia withdraws to the territory it held before February 24th. With Russia on the front foot on the battlefield, this will not happen.
We don't say this operation is against Ukraine, for it's actually NATO who are fighting against our republics now, the collective West. It's now some kind of front line of good and evil. That's why we might be ready to negotiate. The question is, what about? Ukraine has sold its people and its sovereignty to the West against the interest of its population. So these negotiations are with who and about what?
Now, just as Russia has massive political control over the Donetsk People's Republic and the Luhansk People's Republic, so does NATO have huge political control over Ukraine. It arms them, it funds them. And so when negotiations start and what terms will be on offer in negotiations, we're very much down to NATO's decisions rather than Ukrainian government's.
The head of NATO, Jens Stoltenberg, recently said,
President Zelensky has stated many times this war will end at the negotiating table. The question is, what kind of position will the Ukrainians have when they negotiate a solution? Our responsibility is to make that position as strong as possible. We know that there is a very close link between what you can achieve at the negotiating table and your position on the battlefield. So our military support to them is a way to strengthen their hand.
Hundreds of soldiers, both Ukrainian and Russian, are being slaughtered every day in Donbass, so that their governments have a better hand at the negotiating table. Civilians on both sides are dying too. A mother and her 11-year-old child yesterday in Donetsk, killed by shelling of a market. Meanwhile, global leaders warn of a catastrophic global food crisis due to the conflict. Peace is still a long way off, and it looks set to be achieved on the battlefield. Johnny Miller, Donbass.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
A significant part of the case against Roe v. Wade is that the Supreme Court was wrong to intervene in 1973 to recognize a constitutional right to abortion while the democratic process was still playing out. The article you're about to has been written by the New York Times columnist Jamel Bowie. The piece is titled, "The Pro-Democracy Argument Against Roe Falters When It Meets Reality." A significant part of the case against Roe v. Wade is that the Supreme Court was wrong to intervene in 1973 to recognize a constitutional right to abortion, while the democratic process was still playing out. Better instead to have left the issue to the states, to voters and elected officials, who could then tailor their own laws to their respective communities. Justice Samuel Alito takes note of this in his draft opinion overruling Roe. In some states, he writes, voters may believe that the abortion right should be even more extensive than the right that Roe and Casey recognized. Voters in other states, he continues, may wish to impose tight restrictions based on their belief that abortion destroys an unborn human being. He concludes that our nation's historical understanding of ordered liberty does not prevent the people's elected representatives from deciding how abortion should be regulated. The end of Roe in this telling is a victory for democracy against judiciocracy. That might be true if Americans lived with fair and representative institutions. But they don't. And even if they did, there's more to democracy than just voting or the process of making a law. Which is to say that the pro-democracy argument against Roe v. Wade and the constitutional right to have an abortion falters on a few key realities. The first relates to democratic government, or the lack thereof, in the states. The second relates to the expansion of state power inherent in any effective law against abortion. And the third concerns the intimate relationship between bodily autonomy and political equality. And the first point, let's begin with a little Madison. Among the most famous essays in American political thought is Federalist No. 10. In it, James Madison makes his case for the extended republic against naysayers who argue that the United States is too big to be a functional country with a representative government. His argument, in brief, is that the smaller the republic, the more acute the violence of faction, defined here as a group united by some common impulse of passion or of interest, and adverse to the permanent and aggregate interests of the community to its citizens. The smaller the society, Madison writes, the fewer probably will be the distinct parties and interests composing it. The fewer the distinct parties and interests, the more frequently will a majority be found of the same party. And the smaller the number of individuals composing a majority, and the smaller the compass within which they are placed, the more easily will they concert and execute their plans of oppression. He concludes that if you extend the sphere and you take in a greater variety of parties and interests, you make it less probable that a majority of the whole will have a common motive to invade the rights of other citizens. Or if such a common motive exists, it will be more difficult for all who feel it to discover their own strength and act in unison with each other.
Hello.
James Madison's point is that a federalist union will be less vulnerable to the mischiefs of faction than the states it comprises, that the influence of factious leaders may kindle a flame within their particular states, but will be unable to spread a general conflagration through the other states. Now, Madison's theory isn't airtight, mostly because it doesn't anticipate the emergence of national political parties. But it isn't wrong either. It is easier for narrow factions to win power at the state level than for them to win control of the federal government. And this, in essence, is what has happened with abortion. Last year, in a review of public opinion data, the Pew Research Center found 14 states where a majority of adults agreed that abortion should be illegal in all or most cases. State legislatures in each may well outlaw the practice if the Supreme Court overrules Roe v. Wade. But so will legislatures in states where a majority of adults support legal abortion in all or most cases. 56% of Florida adults, according to Pew Research Center, support the status quo under Roe. Despite this, Florida lawmakers have already passed a 15-week abortion ban. A similar situation exists in Oklahoma, where 51% of adults support the right to an abortion in most cases, but where the Republican governor just signed a far stricter ban into law. Then there are states like Arizona, Michigan, and Wisconsin, where pre-Roe bans may take immediate effect if Roe v. Wade is overturned. But Justice Samuel Alito might say if voters do not want their states to ban abortion, they can elect representatives who will then take steps to protect it. That's not so simple. Thanks to Alito's own votes and opinions, and those of his conservative colleagues, in Shelby County versus Holder, Rucho versus Common Cause, and Brnovich versus Democratic National Committee, state legislatures have nearly free rein to restrict voting, gerrymander in a hyper-partisan fashion, and otherwise insulate themselves from democratic accountability. A pro-Roe electoral majority might exist in Wisconsin, but the state Republican Party has gerrymandered itself into durable control of the legislature. It needs only a minority of voters to win a majority of seats. The same is true in states like Ohio and North Carolina, where, according to a New York Times analysis of public opinion data, most adults support Roe. In other words, there are a number of states, home to tens of millions of Americans, where voters may not actually have the power to elect lawmakers to protect the abortion rights they say they want. If states and state legislatures are supposed to be places where democracy happens, and that itself is debatable, then these facts are a real challenge for the pro-democracy case against Roe. Next is a matter of the abortion bans themselves. Although anti-abortion activists insist that they intend to penalize only providers and clinics, lawmakers in Republican-led states have already introduced bills that would criminalize patients as well. But even if that weren't the case, there's simply no way to enforce an abortion ban without the state intruding deeply into women's lives. Think about what it would take to establish that someone had an illegal abortion. The state and its agents would need access to everything from search results, call histories, text messages, and medical records to bank statements, social media posts, and location data. It would need to turn its attention to anyone who may have helped, friends and family included. To this point, the Texas bounty law extends legal liability in exactly this manner. The state would need to treat the womb, any womb, as a potential crime scene, with anything other than a healthy birth as evidence of a possible crime. A miscarriage or stillbirth would have to invite the same scrutiny as an abortion, There is no other place a total ban can go. Indeed, this kind of scrutiny is already part of daily life for many women, especially those who are poor, non-white, or both. The criminalization of pregnancy is not new, but it is poised to get much worse. There is a word for this, and it's certainly not democracy, which brings us to the final problem with the idea that a world without Roe is somehow more democratic. Democracy rests, on paper at least, on the idea of political equality, that all citizens have equal standing and equal say when it comes to representation and political decision-making. But equal standing is undermined and eroded when the state can effectively seize your person for its own ends. That is, when it can force you to give birth. And the erosion of political equality has social consequences. It leads to disregard and disrespect, to treating the people in question as a subordinate class. We know this. Prisoners represent the most extreme end. They are citizens, but they're not political equals. We see it in our history as well. Before Jim Crow, there was a decades-long effort to erode the already tenuous political standing of Black Americans in the aftermath of Reconstruction. To put the right to have an abortion up for debate is to put the bodily autonomy of women up for debate. There's no other way to spin it. It's just the nature of the thing. And to put the bodily autonomy of women up for debate is to degrade their citizenship, their social standing, and their political equality. Assuming Roe is overturned, there may be more legislatures casting votes over the right to have an abortion, but that's not the same as more democracy. Just the opposite. States that ban abortion will undermine the values of democracy and curtail the liberty of their citizens. Subjected to surveillance and criminal scrutiny, people who give birth in those states and those who support their right to privacy and bodily autonomy will live with a degraded form of citizenship. Democracy is substantive as well as procedural. It is a set of values as well as a set of processes. Our system can and should be much more representative than it is.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Former U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has said that Iranian General Qasem Soleimani was assassinated to protect U.S. assets in Iraq, its people in Syria, and in fact, Americans all across the world. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at how the U.S. foreign policy has stooped to such lows as to subscribe to assassinations, while revealing how U.S. presence in the West Asia region has been met by defeat one after another. First, our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Emeritus Professor at Westchester University, Lawrence Davidson, joins us from Westchester, PA. Also joining us, the editor at Veterans Today, Kevin Barrett, who joins us from Madison.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines. featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Let me start with you, if I may, Kevin Barrett. We're looking at what former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has said, the reason why the U.S. assassinated with the direction of Donald Trump by his orders, the former U.S. president of Iranian anti-terror commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, that he said that they did that because they wanted to safeguard U.S. assets in Iraq, its people in Syria, and, in fact, Americans all across the world. What do you think about what he has said?
Well, it's just obviously complete nonsense. Unlike the Americans, General Soleimani and his forces were not targeting people at random. They were not targeting people because they were Americans. And indeed, they weren't even targeting Americans. They had a policy of not going after Americans. And in fact, the U.S. had lured General Soleimani to Iraq en route to supposed peace talks that it pretended to be setting up with Saudi Arabia for some kind of a regional peace agreement or kind of a truce. And so he was on a peace mission, and it was a complete deception. And so the truth, of course, is, as usual, the exact opposite of what you hear from people like Mike Pompeo. That is that General Soleimani had a lot of success at moving the region in a direction that will ultimately result in more peace. And he did that by waging these campaigns of resistance that were overall highly moral and ethical in terms of the conduct of the following rules of war. And so this notion that he was some kind of terrorist who was out to randomly kill Americans, everybody knows that's untrue. And in fact, everybody also knows that Pompeo is an Israeli-controlled neocon who is doing the work of the Zionist lobby, which has so distorted U.S. Middle East policy, and indeed most of the terrorism in the region has come out of either the Zionists directly or indirectly through their American proxy that they hijacked through buying influence and dominating the U.S. and owning people like Mike Pompeo. So Pompeo is not only a liar, but he's also a traitor. He betrayed the United States of America in order to work for the most extreme Likud wing of the Zionist entity.
Okay.
And the war killing General Soleimani was done on behalf of the Israelis, as Trump has practically admitted ever since then.
What we're trying to do over here, Lawrence Davidson, is not to rehash news that has been analyzed before, but to look at it as a window as to how the U.S. foreign policy has been executed, which is very much under question, especially when you have what Mike Pompeo said about the reasons for the assassination of General Soleimani, when you had American intelligence officials to have said that there was no such evidence as to the involvement of General Soleimani's plan for an attack on U.S. forces, because they were Pompeo had said that he was going to attack, or he was going to be responsible for the death of 500 or attack of 500 U.S. personnel. Is that the type of thinking that the foreign policy is under, coming from somebody who, in his case, has said that I was the CIA director, we lied, we cheated, and we stole?
Well, that's pretty accurate. I mean, they do lie, and they do cheat. I don't know about stealing, but I think that the problem is that there's no coordinated overall plan in terms of foreign policy. It's very, very sporadic and reactionary rather than proactive. And so you get these sort of either they're half kind of half baked efforts where you don't follow through, which is like Syria. I mean, the Russians follow through. We don't follow through. and you get...
Why do you think the U.S. doesn't follow through? Why doesn't the U.S. follow through?
Yeah, well, I think that it's sporadic, that they don't, that it, at the political level, they don't really have a plan. So they react in terms of how they feel the policy will react, will spit back in terms of the U.S. reaction, popular reaction, and what have you. And so, really, it's the policymakers' judgment of domestic reaction that really controls how ultimately they'll react in these foreign policy issues. So, and they also misjudge. They misjudge that they. Because they don't either don't know what's going on in these regions, or they don't take the intelligence reports accurately. They don't react accurately to those reports, and so they'll just you know, make up things, and that's what happened in Iraq with Bush, where he just you know. Why are we going into Iraq? Mm-hmm. Well, Saddam had a plot to kill my father. That's U.S. foreign policy. Okay. I mean, you know, it's just silly, stupid things.
Sure. And well, you mentioned Iraq, and I have to come to you, Kevin Baird, with this. Iraq's been talked about. What we are seeing as an output or a consequence of U.S. foreign policy in that country is how the Iraqi parliament voted to ask the U.S. to end its hosting of its troops in Iraq. Basically, they went with a motion to oust all foreign soldiers, including even those from Germany. When you have that type of consequence, that clearly just points to a failed U.S. foreign policy in Iraq. How did the U.S. end up like that in Iraq?
Yes, they've totally failed. The Iraqis have voted against any kind of recognition, to criminalize recognition of Israel. That's, of course, not what PNAC, the Project for a New American Century, wanted when they set these events in motion. Now, I do disagree with the other guest in that I think that there are people who have a plan, but it's not one plan, and it's not based on the U.S. national interest for the most part. I think that the plan was that we had this group around Netanyahu in the mid to late 90s that wanted to totally redraw the boundaries of the Middle East and on behalf of Israel to change the realities on the ground. And they put out a clean break document. And then a few years later, in September of 2000, they put out Rebuilding America's Defenses, which was a thinly disguised claim that this was about helping U.S. Goals, when in fact what it was really about was redrawing the map of the Middle East for Israel. So they blew up the Twin Towers, did a false flag on 9/11, and the purpose of that was to not only unleash these specific wars, but also to change history in favor of Israel and against Islam and Muslims for a century or more. That was what that was all about. So they had a very clear plan, these mm-hmm. neoconservative Zionists who hijacked foreign policy on behalf of Likudnik forces in Israel. But that plan, they didn't completely own U.S. foreign policy, and Professor Davidson is right that there are other forces and all sorts of forces of chaos in foreign policy. The realists pushed back against this and prevented them from going all the way. And sure. So ultimately, this war, which was based on false pretenses, whose real purpose was to destroy the region on behalf of Israel, not to create anything lasting, not to achieve any positive goals, it partially succeeded. It did create tremendous damage in the region. It did create a wave of global Islamophobia that right. Israel will benefit from for decades, if not a century. It's spreading as far as India and so on. And so it did bear some fruit. However, for the United States, it blew up in the face of Uncle Sam, because this really was never an American policy to begin with. It's true, the American side doesn't have a plan. Unfortunately, the Likudnik Zionist side does have plans.
One of the ones that the U.S. has admitted to, Lawrence Davidson, is its policy towards Iran. I mean, the most recent one coming from the U.S. Special Envoy for Vienna talks, the Secretary of State, not to mention the President himself, Biden, who have said that the maximum pressure policy, and they attribute that to Trump, has failed on Iran, even though it's ironic that they're pursuing that policy now. That's another thing about the U.S. pursuing failed policies. You have a policy that's failed, and then you have the current administration following that maximum pressure policy still. Why is that?
Well, Kevin actually touched on this. Policy is often a reaction to powerful special interests, okay? I mean, you can see it domestically with the gun lobby, and you can see it in terms of foreign policy specifically towards the Middle East, given the influence of the Zionists. And so Israel really does not want this Iran nuclear weapons deal to go through. They want it to just flounder. And so
it's a nuclear deal. It's not a nuclear weapons deal. I'm sorry. I had to just correct that. Sorry about that. No, that's okay.
Okay. So they wanted to flounder. And since, Biden has declared himself a Zionist, so who's influencing this jackass policy? It's you put in charge people who are most influenced by Zionists or Zionist elements within the Democratic Party or what have you, and you get this kind of effort to essentially make the policy flounder, make it fail. And so you know that you're pursuing a failed policy, and that's why you're doing it, because you want it to fail. It's a reaction to special interests. I don't particularly agree that there's about grand policies to redraw the Middle East. I think maybe that was in the mind of Bush Jr., but he was nuts anyway. I mean, he's crazy, and he's a criminal. He's a war criminal as a consequence. I think it's some of it is kind of sporadic, and it depends upon who's pushing the political buttons most effectively.
Well, it sounds like maybe the Pentagon is, because when you take a look at what has happened in Yemen, Kevin Barrett, mm-hmm. I mean, that was clearly something that was driven by arms sales. I mean, the former U.S. President Donald Trump didn't make any bones about that in his ostentatious display that he had at the White House when you had the Crown Prince with him. That's a failed policy, and we could see, obviously, what Saudi Arabia had to do, which is concede to talks. Was that policy just driven by arms manufacturers and arms sales?
Yeah, I think that was a lot of it. I think Lawrence is right about the special interests dominating U.S. policy and pushing it first one direction and then that, taking it on these crazy rides like the neocons did with the 9/11 wars. And in this case, yeah, the arms makers are getting rich selling weapons to Saudi Arabia. And Biden revealed himself as a complete hypocrite after pretending that he was the opposite of Trump on this and criticizing Trump. Well, they're all selling out to the Saudis. Obama did. Obama allowed the war in Yemen, if not actually encouraged it. And Trump just went along with that in a more ostentatious way. And now the same thing is happening under Biden, even after he spoke out so vociferously against it when he was campaigning and said he would never do these things that Trump had done. And he would be whipping the Saudis into line and punishing them for killing Khashoggi and so on and so forth. And none of that came true. So he's a liar and a hypocrite, but they all are. And yeah, it's the arms manufacturers are a big part of it. And then there's also the Zionists are actually in favor of the U.S. support for the war on Yemen, because the Zionists don't like the axis of resistance, which Yemen is a part of. So there, that lobby is also pushing it. And I think the folks who, the few people in government that actually care about the interests of the U.S. empire, which I frankly don't care about that much, but they do, and that's their job. So that's what they should be caring about. Those people probably also think that, well, for the near future at least, trying to keep the axis of resistance under control and keep propping up these, you know, friends of Israel in the region as long as we can before the whole thing collapses is really about all we can do. So it's a very chaotic policy. It's driven in contradictory directions and often self-destructive directions by these lobbies
right.
and special interests. And there's really no principled vision, and I think Lawrence was right about that, in terms of thinking out how to have a win-win strategy where the U.S. does okay and other people do as well. Okay. That hasn't existed since the days of Kennedy and Eisenhower, if then.
Well, one of the things that's very striking here is the way that the Syria policy of the U.S. has unfolded, Lawrence Davidson, because when you look at the decade of war that happened there and all types of U.S. allies, including the U.S. itself, indirectly or covertly being involved in it, it not only did not result in the defeat of Syria and the ouster of democratically elected Assad, but rather you have some of the allies who are now receiving Assad with open arms, like the UAE. So you can see how that policy, just from that one particular angle, has also failed. Again, we're trying to break down the U.S. foreign policy here. And in West Asia, in this particular case, my question to you is on Syria. How do you think that unraveled for the U.S.?
Well, I think the initial impulse was essentially to overthrow Assad, okay? And that came also from the Israeli lobby, I think was a shaker and mover in that one. So the problem was that if you were going to overthrow Assad, you had to then surreptitiously anyway, support some really very unsavory terrorist kinds of folks, okay? And so there was a lot of uncertainty about how just to go about this. And that uncertainty, I think, led to a half-assed effort. And pretty soon, the U.S. couldn't compete with the locals. In other words, they didn't have the force and they didn't have the will to compete with Iran or Turkey or even the Russians in this area. And so they lost out. But I think originally they were trying to overthrow Assad, and of course that didn't happen. I think that the Americans in Washington, in other words, the administration is very, very hungry for a win.
Where? Okay?
And that's why they're throwing everything they can into Ukraine.
Uh-huh. Okay, so another obsession. There we're talking about how they want to defeat Putin. All right, so let's look at Saudi Arabia, Kevin Barrett. Saudi Arabia obviously was one of the strongest allies that the U.S. could count on for the West Asia or the Middle East region, but we are looking how that relationship has been strained, especially through Biden calling it a pariah state and at this point not even talking to the Crown Prince. And it seems like he's going to be making a visit to the region, putting aside all of that and the human rights that Saudi Arabia is obviously violating for oil, because obviously there's a need for it. But is Saudi Arabia going to receive the U.S. president, and is that another U.S. foreign policy failure?
It is. It's a failure because it's obvious that it's the American side that's afraid of the Saudi side, which is kind of bizarre because since World War II, it's the U.S. that's been propping up this regime in Riyadh, arming them. They can't even use a lot of their weapons or fly their own planes, so the Americans send over their pilots and advisors and technicians and stuff. So it's really been kind of a U.S. Proxy state, where the Americans get a deal. They have the Saudis export the oil only in dollars, and the Americans get the right to sell all the military equipment, make a lot of money. And the Americans have been the dominant party for a long time. And last time the Saudis got uppity was actually right before 9/11 in August. The king said that Saudi Arabia was going to have to go its own way and leave the U.S. empire because of the U.S. support for Israel. And then suddenly 9/11 happened, and a bunch of high-level Saudis who had supported that policy suddenly died. And then the next thing you know, Saudi Arabia has been reeled in. So the U.S. seemed like it was still in charge. But now they're not anymore. Now the clown prince can, you know, we all see him as a clown prince, but he's got the upper hand over the Americans somehow. He can tell them, he can refuse to take their phone calls. They call him begging him to pump more oil, and he doesn't even take the phone call. And so then Biden abjectly drops all of his demands for any kind of improvement on human rights and just goes there with his begging bowl to the king, to the crown prince of Saudi Arabia. Okay. So somehow what's happened here? Apparently the U.S. has lost so much prestige and so much soft power and perhaps hard power as well, losing the war in Syria, allowing the Russians to win in Georgia even before that. And now the Russians are on course to defeat NATO and win in Ukraine as well. And so the U.S. is a fading power. And Biden's abject surrender to the Saudis is a sign of that.
Okay. Talk about money, since I've heard that now in the statements. Lawrence Davidson, it was very shocking in a sense for many when the Afghanistan war and U.S. occupation there was ongoing, that the Pentagon comes out and says, we don't even know how much money we have spent, because based on the accounting that took place, they couldn't account for billions of dollars, and I'm talking hundreds of billions of dollars, that was cited in a report. We can go on about that, but I'm curious as to whether these ventures, which all cost money, is about money.
Well, yes, I think that it's a lot of it is about money, and the nature of these ventures essentially creates a sphere or a environment for corruption. I mean, when you are distributing, you know, either in actual dollars or in materiel, millions and millions and millions of dollars per week, some of that is going to generate corruption. And and corruption then becomes its own engine. So essentially, if you're not paying attention, or on purpose or otherwise, or if you don't care how the money is spent, then, or how the money ultimately is distributed, then in fact it's an invitation for not being able to account for billions of bucks.
Okay. We got less than 30 seconds here left. Kevin Barrett, former U.S. President Donald Trump, we have spent $7 trillion with a T in the Middle East, as he called it. You know what we have for it? Nothing. Does the U.S. have nothing to show for it in the Middle East or West Asia, as we call it?
Pretty much, yeah. Once again, Trump may lie, and he's certainly not a reliable source. He's not very knowledgeable, but he speaks a lot of truth that nobody else is willing to speak that directly. He's absolutely right. Yeah, we spent $7 trillion and actually made our position worse. If the U.S. had just gotten out and stopped spending money on the region completely, rather than doing all these crazy things since the 9/11 false flag, we could have saved $7 trillion, okay, and we would actually have a better position in the region right now for not being there.
Thank you, Kevin Barrett, editor at Veterans Today, and thank you, Lawrence Davidson, emeritus professor at Westchester University. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight from Mikhail Tahway and the team. It's goodbye.